Well, did you notice that there's only one slide left? Oh, you did not notice that. Well, that means either I'm going to have to talk about this one slide for 75 minutes, which I could do, or we could finish up early. What I think of the best thing to do is for me to finish this slide, and then and therefore the chapter, and therefore the unit material. And then after I'm done with this slide, if no one has any questions, we're done. But if not, we should treat it as a little review session. So anything from the first unit that you're unsure of before Wednesday's test, have a question in mind when I'm done with this slide. Okay? What we're looking at here is what? What is this thing in slide 13? Well, it is a reaction, yeah. I shouldn't say this thing because that's ambiguous. What is the reactant on the left here? ATP, which is an acronym. So you could see that from this, but what does ATP stand for? What is it? Adenosine triphosphate, exactly. Which is why the cartoon for that molecule is drawn the way it is, because it shows you that it's adenosine with three phosphates attached to it. Now, adenosine is itself, if you consider just adenosine, which is a molecule in its own right, if that's all there is, if nothing is connected to it. Adenosine is an example of a specific kind of molecule called a nucleoside. Now, what is that word very similar to that you already know? Nucleotide. The only difference is the S versus a T. So, did we already talk? I genuinely forget whether we did or not. But did we talk about what the three components of a nucleotide are? I think we did. Actually, let me get even a little bit more basic. A nucleotide with a T, what is that? What do you know that as? I mean, what kind of thing is it? Not specifically adenosine triphosphate, but just any nucleotide. What's the important thing about a nucleotide? Or what is it? Yeah.
Why wouldn't the organism with the nucleus?
It's
like the nucleus itself, right?
No. It's obviously there's that same root in it, nucleo.
Yeah.
And that comes from, it's kind of an indirect of an indirect. Because what is the nucleus famous for containing? DNA, which is short for what? Deoxyribonucleic acid. It is, DNA that is one of two major kinds of nucleic acid, right? What's the other major category?
RNA.
They're both nucleic acids. And they get their nuclear combining form in their name from the fact that DNA is found in the nucleus, assuming you're looking at a eukaryotic cell, right? That's where the DNA is found. So that's how nucleic acids got their name, from eukaryotic nucleus in which DNA is housed. But as far as molecules are concerned, DNA are big molecules, right? Otherwise known as macromolecules. They are nucleic acids, and nucleic acids are one of the four kinds of macromolecules, right? Even more specifically, well, let me just start that sentence over. Of those four macromolecules that we keep mentioning, three of them are not only big, like all four are, but they're also properly classified as polymers because they're made by hooking together a bunch of subunits called monomers, right? What, by the way, are those three polymers? Well, let's back up and say, what are the four macromolecules in general? Yeah.
Nucleic acids.
Yes.
Well,
Nucleic acids, polysaccharides,
lipids,
and proteins. Now remember, some of those have multiple different names that you can choose from among because they're interchangeable terms, right? What's the what's another name for a nucleic acid? Actually, let me save that one for a second. What's another name for a protein?
Polypeptide.
The word has poly in it, so it should remind you that it's a polymer. Right? In the case of a polypeptide, what are the monomers that you string together to make those? In other words, what are proteins made out of? What subunits?
Amino acids.
Okay. What is another name for a... Polysaccharide is another word that has poly in it. So that should tell you that polysaccharides is also a polymer. Okay, so polypeptides are macromolecules that are polymers. Polysaccharides are macromolecules that are polymers. What are the monomers that make up polysaccharides? What are the monomers that make up polysaccharides? Monosaccharides, yes. Simple sugars are hooked together to form complex sugars, which is just another word for a polysaccharide. Okay, so that's two of the four that we've named as polymers. Now, nucleic acids also go by a different name. What is that?
Polynucleotides,
exactly. So lipids, first of all, that's the out group in this way of classifying them. Lipids are macromolecules, but they are not polymers. Right? They're built a little bit differently. The other three macromolecule classes are polymers, in addition to just being macromolecules. Okay? And the word polynucleotide is exactly analogous to the word polysaccharide. Polysaccharides are polymers made out of monomers named monosaccharides. Polynucleotides are polymers made out of monomers that are called nucleotides. All right? And a nucleotide, as a building block of nucleic acids, a nucleotide consists of three pieces. Even though the nucleotide is considered a single subunit, and the overall nucleic acid will have a hell of a lot of those subunits. Each subunit actually has three parts to it. Okay, you following me on that? And those three parts are a pentose sugar, so named because it has five carbons. Okay? And that pentose sugar is one of two choices. Depends on whether it's DNA or RNA. If it's an RNA nucleotide, then that is ribose, the sugar ribose. If it's DNA nucleotide, then the sugar is deoxyribose. More about that in a different chapter after the first test. But sugar is one of the three components of just one subunit that we call a nucleotide. Hooked to that are two different things. A nitrogenous base, which I'll just abbreviate as NB. A nitrogenous base, obviously, is something that contains nitrogen. That's what nitrogenous means. And on the other side of the sugar is connected a phosphate group, which I'm abbreviating as P with a circle around it, just like in this cartoon. P with a circle around it, you have to be careful about. That does not mean a phosphorus atom. P by itself means a phosphorus atom, because P is the symbol for phosphorus, right? P with a circle around it is really shorthand for the phosphate group that you learned last time, which includes what? What's in a phosphate group? And a phosphorus atom. So there's still a phosphorus atom there, but you have oxygens all around it, four oxygens, right? And one of those oxygens is what's making the link to the R, the rest of the molecule. Okay, so this is really shorthand notation. There's four oxygens there as well for each of these P's. Okay. Well, anyway, if you have all these three things in place, a pentose sugar that's connected both to a nitrogenous base and to a phosphate group, then you have a nucleotide. All right, which is a building block or a monomer of a nucleic acid. That's one of the reasons it's important. Now, the reason I'm going through all of this is because if you have just the sugar and the nitrogenous base, then that's not a nucleotide, because I'm imagining here that it doesn't have the phosphate. Since it doesn't have the phosphate, it's not a complete nucleotide, right? If it's just the sugar and the base, we call it a nucleoside. All right? Which is why, if you have the whole thing here, the sugar, the base, and a phosphate group, you could call that a nucleotide, but you could also call it a nucleoside monophosphate. Right? Because it's a nucleoside with one phosphate group attached to it. Nucleotide simply means you have all three, and including among those three is at least one phosphate. It doesn't have to be one. It can be more than one. So ATP, which is adenosine triphosphate, gets its name because it is the particular nucleoside that we call adenosine, which is named for its particular nitrogenous base, which is adenine. Right? The A's, T's, C's, and G's that DNA has in its code, those are four different kinds of nitrogenous base. The A is adenine, and if you connect that with a ribose sugar to form a nucleoside, that particular nucleoside is called adenosine, named after its nitrogenous base. Okay? That's adenosine by itself. If you then hook on a phosphate, you have a nucleotide that could also be called adenosine monophosphate. Does that all make sense? And if you hooked another one on, another phosphate to the existing phosphate, you would have adenosine diphosphate. And if you hooked another one onto that, daisy chaining these phosphates together, you have adenosine triphosphate. Now that's famous in its own right. ATP is famous for being an important energy-carrying molecule. But it's also a nucleotide. It's also could be used as a monomer for building a long chain of nucleotides for RNA. I say RNA because the sugar that's part of adenosine is ribose, not deoxyribose. So this ATP is important as a building block for RNA, and it's also important just as a molecule in its own right for the purpose of very temporarily storing energy. Okay, so we talked about this analogy of calling it the energy currency of the cell already, right? We went through this. It's really, the analogy really stands up well if you consider it not to be cash, but a debit card. Not a credit card either, a debit card. Right? Which a debit card is worthless unless you have a balance in the corresponding account, right? Well, when you make deposits to that account, you're loading it with money. You're loading that debit card with money. Similarly, you can load this nucleotide with more energy by adding additional phosphate groups to it. Okay? So an AMP molecule, which is not shown here, but you can easily imagine the cartoon of, it would be adenosine with just one phosphate on it. Adenosine monophosphate is like a debit card with a very low balance. And probably not alone in that. Adenosine monophosphate needs to be given additional energy for it to be a useful molecule for the cell. And by useful, I mean so that the cell can get some of that energy back that's being stored by it. Okay? So AMP can be converted into ADP, which can then be converted into ATP, which you should think of as a debit card with a nice big balance. Okay? So, yeah, go ahead.
Does it also ever go further than the free phosphates?
I'm not going to say never because I don't know the answer to that. I mean, it's not chemically impossible. I just don't know whether that ever happens in real living cells.
So then in this case, this is not equal to going over
the right, right. ATP you should think of as the full energy-carrying molecule.
The biggest amount you can
have. Yes. Debit cards don't really have a limit to how many deposits you can make, but think of it that way.
Yeah.
Okay? Now, I said that this is temporary energy storage, and it's very temporary because almost as soon as ATP molecules get produced in order to store the energy, they get used again. So this reaction is shown only in one direction, to the right, but this is a reversible reaction. You can run this in either direction. When we're running it to the right, as shown here, though, what we're doing is spending the energy that's being stored in ATP. Well, where did that energy come from to make this originally? We store energy temporarily in ATP, but where is the energy originally? Now, don't overthink this. Well, what do you do for your energy needs? You eat, yes. The energy was in the food originally, in the chemical bonds of the molecules in the food that you ate. Okay? And this is why we call it energy currency. Right? The analogy here is that you don't work, you don't put in the effort for whatever work you do directly for your needs, right? You don't work directly for your housing, for instance, or for anything else you need. You work instead for money, which stores your effort, in a sense. It represents what you've worked. And then you spend that money for a great variety of things. Similarly, you bring in energy as food, but you don't use that energy from your food to directly do the things in the cell that require energy. Like moving things around from one part of the cell to another part of the cell. That's an expensive process. That doesn't come for free. But you don't directly use the food energy to do that. Instead, after you've digested your food into small enough chunks that can be put into your body through the small intestine, you then, within cells, catabolize those or burn those fuels that were food molecules originally, releasing energy. And some of that energy gets captured in the form of ATP molecules. In other words, to build this ATP molecule out of an ADP molecule, which you do by reversing this reaction and sticking an additional phosphate onto the ADP to make it ATP, that requires energy. That energy comes from your food. So now you have an energy-storing molecule, ATP, that is much more versatile than the food molecule, because if you now spend this ATP by reversing the process of building it. You split that terminal phosphate off to turn it back into ADP. The energy that it took from the food to make that ATP is now released again. And that energy, some of that energy that's released, can be used for a hell of a lot of different things, like to power a pump or contract a muscle, whatever. That's the versatility of it. Just like money is versatile. You can buy a lot of different things. ATP is versatile in terms of spending the energy. All right. So even though ATP is a nucleotide and it's therefore an important building block of an RNA molecule, That's a totally different use of this molecule. When we're talking about ATP by itself, really has nothing to do with RNA, even though it is an RNA nucleotide, chemically speaking. It's not being used to build RNA, it's being used to temporarily store energy. And temporarily, very short temporary, because like I said a little bit ago, just about as soon as these things are made, the reverse process occurs because the cell needs it. And so it'll break it back down. And you have trillions and trillions and trillions of these molecules in your body because you have trillions of cells, and each cell has many, many of these ATPs that's being used inside. But it's your pool of ATP is continuously being used and then reformed. So it's really, I shouldn't say your pool of ATP, your pool of adenosine nucleotides is continuously undergoing change from ATP to ADP and then back. Okay? So you only have so many of these nucleotides in your body. At any given moment, some of them are ATP, some of them are ADP, and a fewer number are AMP. Because you could continue this. There would be you could have another arrow after this. ADP can then be converted into AMP and a phosphate. But that's where you're getting a very low balance. And we'll talk much more about this in the energy unit that's coming up. But if your cells start to have a buildup of AMP, that's a strong signal to the cell that you are using too much ATP and ADP without replenishing it. In other words, you need to ramp up production in the other direction, which production is the opposite direction, right? So that you have enough ATP on hand, right? Because if you run out of AMP, then you're dead. You don't have that available energy anymore. Most of it is either ATP or ADP, and continuously they're going back and forth depending on whether it's being used or built. Now, on the right side, since we're just spending a single ATP in this example, you spend it by cleaving that terminal phosphate-phosphate bond between the second and the third phosphate, okay? When you do, that third phosphate, which used to be part of ATP, is now on its own. And tell me again what a phosphate group includes. Not phosphate. Four oxygens and what else? A phosphorus atom, right? A phosphorus atom and four oxygen atoms. Now, that's a functional group if the whole thing is connected to a carbon skeleton, right? The R, whatever that is. But that's not what's happening here because you've cleaved it off of this. This is the R. If it's no longer connected to the R, it's no longer part of an organic molecule, right? And that's why we call it inorganic phosphate at that point. There's no carbon that it's connected to. So that's just another name for a phosphate on its own, and that's what the I subscript indicates. P with the circle is still phosphate, but it's inorganic phosphate if that's all it is. It's not connected to a carbon skeleton. Yeah.
Is that inorganic phosphate? I mean, I don't know if you're going too far, but is it then used again for another reaction?
That's right. This is an important point. I said you have a pool of adenosine-based nucleotides, ADP and ATP mostly. And similarly, you have a pool continuously of phosphates, inorganic phosphates, that one moment will be an inorganic phosphate, and the next moment they'll find themselves attached to an ADP or an ATP. So those go back and forth all the time. Along with phosphate's other important jobs. Remember, I mentioned several important things about phosphate. This is just the energy carrying capacity of it. Yeah.
So then that's why you said that if you run out, or if you're taking too much ADP or ATP, that you end up, well, the body has a reaction, and then obviously if you run out, you die.
Right. Now, we did a tour of the cell, and in that chapter we studied the various organelles, right? most of which, everything except ribosomes, are membrane-bounded organelles, right? What did I say was the primary function of the mitochondrion? Don't make the mistake of waiting until the last night before a test. That is not a good thing to do. Primary function of the mitochondrion. Cellular respiration, which we'll study in detail in the hardest part of the course, which is Unit 3. But cellular respiration, without getting into the details of it, is a complex set of reactions that maximizes the number of ATP molecules that can be produced from the energy of the fuel molecules that come from food. Okay? So that cellular respiration process is not always maximized. It would be wasteful to do that, right? The cell adjusts the rate at which cellular respiration is occurring in mitochondria to make sure it's matching the needs for ATP. And what I was saying about AMP, getting back to the reason I started this sentence or paragraph, is that if the cell notices that AMP is building up, meaning you've spent not only your ATPs but your ADPs, that tells the cell you need to ramp up cellular respiration in the mitochondria to match the demand for energy. And that's why it's a strong signal. Okay? If you almost the entire pool is ATP already, then that means you can slow down. You can let off of the accelerator in terms of what's happening in the mitochondrion because you don't need that much energy right now. So it goes up and down. Now, was there a question, a hand I saw come up in the middle of that somewhere? Okay. We're going to talk a lot more about this molecule in other chapters, but that's enough information for now. Just realize that chemically speaking, it is a nucleotide. Whenever we talk about ATP, it's a nucleotide, even though it might not be used as a building block for RNA. It can be, but it works on its own as well. All right, now, that's the end of the chapter and the end of the unit. First of all, did everyone remember to get a Scantron? Or actually, multiple Scantrons. You should get a term's worth while you're over there. Hopefully everyone will remember one on Wednesday. What is it that you want to ask me questions about, if anything, for the upcoming exam?
Is it like a even distribution of all these little subtopics, or is it like one topic you go more into than others?
Well, I try to kind of match it. You know, if there's a topic that I spend a lot more time on than another topic, I will try to have correspondingly more questions about that bigger topic than the smaller one. But it's not a perfect adjustment, of course. Anything that I say on my recordings, though, is fair game for the tests. So, it's exactly 50 questions. They're all multiple choice. Every one of them is four choices, A, B, C, D. So that's the answers to the test, A, B, C, and D. You just need to figure out what the order is. Yeah.
You said that one of the labs is going to be on our lecture test, and it was the molecular modeling, the functional groups, right?
Well, actually, it's the other way around, because, definitely everything from all the slides from the chapters are part of the lecture exams. But what I said in lab is that since the lab involved functional groups, the functional groups, which are slides 11 and 12, those are for the lecture exam and for the quiz purposes. You need to know that for the lab as well. Mm-hmm. But by the way, since you brought that up, there will be a time when I'm going to give you just part of a chapter, I think three slides, maybe four at most, from an upcoming chapter. I'm going to give you that in lab, even though it counts as lecture material. I'll explain that again, but that's what you reminded me to say. Well, what were you going to say?
So is that like the only thing from lab that's going to be on the test, or is it like everything?
Well, I mean, there's coincidentally some a lot of things that overlap, right?
Well, yeah, I have to do, but you know.
But anything that overlaps is going to be on it simply because of the overlap. Think about it in terms of what I say on my lecture recordings. That is the collection of information that you need to master, which is why listening to the recordings is by far the most important thing. And making a good set of notes from those recordings at home, stopping, writing it out, and studying the hell out of those notes. Now, this is something you should have already been doing on a daily basis. If you're trying to cram it into one night, that's when people start realizing that they're not going to make it through the course.
Right, and so that's... So I went to look over, that was 12 your lecture plays,
mm-hmm.
right? And then that's all on the website.
Right.
And then at that point, that's where we just review our notes.
Right.
To see what is good, what looks good, and what would be on the text.
Yes, and ideally, you should be following my... my best ideas for studying, which are on the bonus points page, and especially the one about giving your own lectures. Give that a try, you know, just sitting alone in a room or whatever, but actually speak it out loud. Try to give a mini lecture. Pick a topic, not an entire chapter, but a topic. Put your notes away, just like on test day, you're not going to be able to look at anything. So put everything away and see whether you can explain that topic, everything you learned about it, without looking at anything. And that's going to not only make you learn it better by actually speaking it. You know, reading it puts it in one part of your brain. Saying it puts it into another. Hearing it puts it into another. And the more copies you have in your brain of that same information, the more likely it is that you'll be able to draw from one of those during the stressful test situation. So do it for that reason. But the other reason is that when you get caught and you have to look at your notes in order to rescue yourself, then that tells you exactly the place in the notes where you need to study more. You know, the parts you can breeze through, you're ready for.
When is that test?
Wednesday. Yeah. But keep an eye on the schedule on the syllabus, because everyone should be fully aware that Wednesday is the test, right? Keep an eye on that last page. Now, any questions about actual material? Is there any part of these first four chapters you're unsure of? Or that you want me to explain again, I mean? Yeah.
Could you define entropy?
Well, entropy is something we haven't gotten to yet. So, well, I actually did mention entropy, didn't I? Yeah, okay. Entropy is roughly disorder. And so, the reason I mentioned it so far, and we'll mention it again in a different unit, is that organisms, remember when we talked about those seven things that all organisms have in common? One of those, they're highly ordered structures, right? They're not the only highly ordered structures. There are some non-living things that are very highly ordered, like crystals. But organisms of all types are very highly ordered. And therefore, they have low entropy, lower than their surroundings, which their non-living surroundings, which are more disorderly. The more disorderly you are, the higher the entropy. And so, the reason that this can be, since the second law of thermodynamics says what? What does the second law tell us? Yes, entropy of the universe is always increasing. So the energy, the universe is kind of winding down. It's becoming more and more disordered. The reason that organisms with their high degree of order are not a violation of the second law is that the only way you can make an organism very highly ordered is to make the surroundings, the rest of the universe in other words, even more disordered than the amount of order you put into the organism. So when you add them together, you still are making more and more disorder overall. Okay? And so that's definitely enough to know for test one about entropy. We'll talk about it again later. Anything else, topic-wise? Yeah?
So I got a question about orbitals.
Okay.
And I know that orbitals have the they have like subshells and then like secondary shells.
No, orbitals do not have subshells.
No.
Orbitals are members of subshells.
Okay. Right.
There's three different spaces, right? No structure, it's just spaces.
Yeah.
Orbitals are the smallest. They make up bigger spaces called subshells, which themselves make up even bigger ones called shells or energy levels. What else can you tell me about orbitals, though? What's important about orbitals?
Yeah, there's two different types of... I put down here like letters.
Yeah.
But it's like S and P.
Yeah, those are the two that we talked about in this course. There are other kinds of orbitals as well. There are D orbitals and F orbitals, but we won't get into those in this course. How do you know whether you're looking at a S orbital or a P orbital? What's different about them? Their shape, right? S orbitals are spherical. P orbitals are dumbbell shaped. But what else, just about any given orbital in general, what can you say about it? Without even knowing whether it's S, P, D, or F. Yeah.
Holds two electrons.
It holds at most two electrons, right? So it could have zero, it could have one, or it could have two electrons. There's three possibilities for any given orbital. But never more than two. Which is why once an orbital is full, if there are additional electrons, they have to be held in other orbitals, right? And when a subshell fills, that gives special stability to that atom, right? And that's the basis for 2 and 8 being important numbers in this regard, right? What's special about 2? What does that refer to? The first shell or energy level, which corresponds on the periodic table to what? What are shells correspond to? No. They don't correspond to electrons either. On the periodic table, what is a shell represented as on the periodic table? A period. What is a period?
It's like the row.
A row, exactly. We don't call them rows. They are rows, of course. But the rows on the periodic table are called periods. And each period represents a different energy level or shell. Now, when you look at this first period, notice it only has two elements in it. And that's because the first period, the first energy level, I mean, contains only one overall orbital, the S orbital. That's why helium is happy. It fills that completely, right? Energy level 2 has its own S orbital plus 3 different P orbitals, right? Which each can hold 2 for a total of 8. All right? And then after that you have the D block and then the F block, but we don't care about this in this course. That's why 8, though, is the magic number for the second period. Right? There's how many orbitals overall in the second shell?
How many orbitals in the second shell?
Yeah.
Three.
No.
Oh, sorry. P orbitals?
There's 3 P orbitals. How many orbitals overall?
Two, four.
4 overall, because that second shell, like all shells, has its own S. Right? We only see P orbitals starting with the second shell. So 2 and up have their own set of 3 different P orbitals. P's always come in 3s. S's always come in 1s. And that's why the second shell has an overall number of 4 orbitals, right? An S and 3 different P's. For a total of 8 possible electrons that it can hold. And that's why if you have 8 electrons in that second shell, you're nice and happy, like helium. But helium, how many overall electrons does helium have?
8.
No. How many overall electrons does helium have? No. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Helium does. I've been talking about helium. Sorry. Remember, things that are in the same group have similar characteristics, groups or columns. So right below helium is neon, which is what I was saying. It's important, by the way, to always listen to what I'm thinking, not necessarily what I'm saying. But neon right below helium has how many overall electrons? 10, yes. It's stable because 8 of those 10 fill up its outer shell, right? What do we call those electrons?
Valence.
Those are the valence electrons, right? Which is smaller. It's always greater than, I mean, less than or equal to the number of total electrons, right? In the case of hydrogen, the only electrons it has are valence electrons because it's only that one shell that we talk about. But speaking of valence electrons, what's the difference between valence electrons and valence?
The valence is how many you need.
How many additional ones will fill up that shell, right? Or subshell specifically, but it's okay to think of it as shell in this class. And therefore, give me an example for oxygen, for instance, has how many valence electrons? It does have 6, a total of 8 electrons because it is element number 8, right? So that's what makes it oxygen. Nothing to do with the electrons. It's element number 8 because it has exactly 8 protons. That alone makes it oxygen. A neutral atom, therefore, will have correspondingly 8 electrons. 2 fill up shell 1, and therefore it has 6 valence electrons, 6 electrons in the outer shell. And therefore the valence is what? 2, which, why is the valence important? What does that tell you beyond the definition of it, that it needs 2 more? What does it tell you practically?
How many covalent bonds you can make?
Right. This explains why oxygen, whenever it's a member of a molecule, will be forming 2 bonds total, right? Could be 2 single bonds. It could be a double bond. But it's going to be forming 2, just like in water, or just like in any monosaccharide that oxygen is always present in. Right? It's always going to be 2. Anything else? Are we adjourned then, or do you want to keep asking? Yeah, go ahead.
One more thing, sorry. So I got here in my notes, I want to make sure it's correct.
Yeah.
Electrons minus
a... Yeah.
Charge atom.
Mm-hmm.
And then neutron is a...
Not a charge... No, an electron is not a charged atom. It's a charged particle.
Okay.
A charged atom, we usually wouldn't use that phrase. We would use what word instead? Ion. It could be a cation or an anion, depending on the charge. But, yeah. And when we use the word atom, we're really implying that it's not charged overall. In other words, there are as many electrons as there are protons.
Right. And then, so I got neutrons, protons. What is an anion?
An anion is just a negatively charged ion.
Okay. And then so cation.
How are they formed? How do you form an anion from an atom? By adding at least one more electron. Yeah, keep in mind, electrons are negatively charged, so when you add negatives to the sum, which is 0 in an atom, you add another -1, it becomes overall -1. That's an anion. How do you make a cation? By eliminating at least one electron. And I say at least one because it will be exactly 1 for all of the elements that are in group 1. Hydrogen forms an ion by losing that only electron it has. That's why it's otherwise known as a proton. Hydrogen atom and proton, same thing. But lithium, sodium, potassium, all of these in this first group will always form a positive 1 cation because they are going to lose 1 electron. Right? That's all they have. Being in this group means they have just 1 in that valence shell, which is much more empty than it is full, and therefore easier to just lose it. in which case we no longer consider that to be the valence shell anymore since it's empty. So it reverts to just the one before it, which is nice and happy. Right? What kind of things do that? What kind of atom or what kind of elements make ions by losing electrons to become cations? Metals. But the second group, sodium, magnesium, calcium, and so on, those are always going to lose two electrons to become ions because they have two in their valence shell, right? Still more empty than full, but they have to lose them both for you to eliminate that outer shell and revert to the one below it that's already full. Right? So that's why you have to have a number for the charge as well for some ions. Like magnesium is not written as Mg plus. Magnesium ion, that is. Magnesium atom would be Mg, but it's in ion form, you'd have to write that as Mg2 plus to indicate that it has lost its two valence electrons to be stable. Yeah?
So you know how, like, with covalent bonds, it's considered a molecule. For ionic bonds, is it always considered a salt?
Yeah, salt is just another word for an ionic compound. And what phrase do we use for the smallest possible bit of a given salt? The smallest possible bit of a covalent substance is a molecule. What's the smallest bit of salt that you can have?
A formula unit.
Right. Now, for instance, using magnesium as an example, that's a positive 2 charged cation. When it forms a salt with, for instance, fluoride, starts out as fluorine, the element, right, neutral, but fluoride, the ion's name, forms by taking on an additional electron, right? So one possible salt is magnesium fluoride, which is going to involve an Mg and an F. Those are the symbols, right? But that's not the correct formula for magnesium fluoride, because you need two fluoride ions, each of which are negative one charge, to add up to a negative 2 that will counteract the positive 2 of magnesium. So MgF2 is magnesium fluoride. And this tells you exactly what a formula unit is. The smallest piece of magnesium fluoride consists of one magnesium and two fluoride ions. And that's it. In a bigger chunk of it, you have as many magnesiums and fluorides as you want, as long as it's a 1-to-2 ratio of magnesium ions to fluoride ions. Sodium chloride, though, table salt, 1-to-1, NaCl. Were you asking something else? Or?
No.
Anything else? Is that final?
I have an individual question.
You mean a 1-to-1 with me?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
What is auto-ionization
mean? Auto-ionization refers to the self-ionization, auto means self, of water. If you have a population of water, so trillions and trillions of water molecules, the vast majority of those will just be ordinary water molecules, right? Neutral molecules, one oxygen, two hydrogens each. But at any given moment, a small fraction of that population of molecules will split into ions. And so one water molecule, H2O, will become a proton, otherwise known as a hydrogen ion, right? One of these hydrogens, atoms, will leave just as the proton, not the electron. The electron will stay behind. Okay, so that's this proton. And what's left is the oxygen, the full hydrogen that hasn't been affected, plus the electron from the other hydrogen that left, right? So that is OH plus, OH minus. That's autoionization. A water molecule splits into two ions. hydrogen ion, which is a cation, and hydroxide ion, which is an anion. And the next moment, it could reverse and go back to water. So it's not that that hydrogen ion and that hydroxide ion are going to stay in that form. They can reform or to form another water molecule. The point is that at any given moment, however many total you have, 1 times 10 to the negative 7th moles of those water molecules per liter, which we know as molar, right, will be in ionized form. And so you'll have 10 to the negative 7th hydrogen ions per mole per liter, and you'll also have the same number per liter of hydroxide, because you can't make one without making the other, right? But that's why that negative 7th is why we center the pH scale on 7. Because pH is the negative base 10 log of the hydrogen ion concentration. Well, the positive log of 10 to the negative 7th is negative 7. The negative of that is positive 7. That's what pure water has as its concentration of hydrogen ions just based on its own autoionization without adding anything to it. Right? If you add an acid to that water, it's going to split into hydrogen ions and whatever else is in that compound. Depends on the type of acid. But that means you're going to add additional hydrogen ions, and therefore this exponent is going to go up numerically, which means it's going to become less negative, right? It's going to go to maybe negative 6 if you add, if it's 10 times as concentrated. And that's going to make the pH go down because of the definition of pH. But you wouldn't find that in pure water. You'd find that only if you've added an acid to water. Okay, last call for questions. I mean, we could take the whole rest of the time, but if you're not going to be asking them, there's no, it makes for boring recording when I'm just waiting for people to raise their hands. Okay, you satisfied? All right, see you Wednesday with a Scantron.